Hello.
Hi.
Hi, how are you, Kirsty?
Good, and you?
Happy Friday.
Happy Friday.
I've actually emulated your all the best, by the way. I absolutely love it. Every time I see you, it just makes me smile. It's the weirdest thing. It's like a really wild trigger.
So funny. Yeah, you can have it.
I just added it to my email signature.
Nice.
So do we have people in the waiting room?
We do. We
I
have.
wonder if you should add power because that's probably Eddie Power.
Yeah, that's what I'm wondering. I think I can, because I know his wife also signed up. Do you want me to admit them?
Yep, they're probably together, so.
Okay. And now I'll unmute them.
Hi, Eddie.
Hi, Natalie. How are you?
I'm doing wonderfully. I love the backdrop there.
Thank you.
Is it real or is it you really have some cool wood stuff in your place?
I have some wood panels, after a couple of months of doing this.
Was going to say, was it because of staying home and working, or is it because you had extra time and you thought you would do a woodworking project?
No, it was the former, unfortunately. I'm not that adept at woodwork, I have to say.
That is so funny. That's cool. So, how has the family adapted to the working from home?
Good, actually, overall. The kids came back from college, and they've all been working online. We've each been finding our own space, and we're fortunate enough to have enough space in the house that we can find our own little corner, so to speak. So,
And how have you been? This is not something that's often discussed, but what about exercise? Is that something that's kind of put you off at all of not being able to get out and do the usual routine?
no. So I have a small home gym. So I've always, start of the day every morning. I've always been down there even before this work from home. So
Yeah.
it hasn't really impacted me. And then weekends I tend to cycle. So keeping that up. How about yourself?
Well, good for you. And I think that, I feel fortunate too. I actually feel very fortunate. I actually have a Finnish sauna, and
Oh,
a little
wonderful.
weight room. So I very similar to yourself, really haven't been. I try to say this very carefully because unfortunately COVID has become a bit of a political
Absolutely.
issue. And so I'm careful about who I tell that to, but my life has been absolutely fine. And thankfully, health remains with the family. So, but no, I similarly, walk every day and
Yep.
looking forward to getting back on my bike as well and warming up here. So it's all good. Just real one quickly, Kirsty, can I just make sure as soon as we start my introduction that you remove the slide?
Yep, no problem.
Awesome. So we're just going to wait a few more minutes for people to log in.
Sure.
And then we are going to go for it. So should be a fun discussion. I always enjoy these. These are my favorite thing I get to do for the day, is talking
Looking
to really
forward.
cool people like yourself. So how long have you been working from home, and what's the latest and greatest
Yeah.
over at Pfizer?
Well, so for us, we started March. Latest, I'm in Pennsylvania, so Pennsylvania is saying June the 4th until it moves out of, it's in the so-called red phase at the moment. We're trying to take into account federal guidelines, state guidelines. It's complex. But June is probably, I would imagine for us in PA with a Pfizer site, it'd probably be more like July, I would have thought.
And do you think that, and just like everything, I mean, it took a while before everybody realized the seriousness of this, and then people started to close. I think we're going to see a similar cadence.
Yes.
Excuse the bike term because I'm a cyclist as well. I think we're going to see a similar cadence in terms of the uptake of people, A, spending money, B, going back to work, C, you know, just kind of revving back. It doesn't start like fits and starts like that. It takes a while before the machinery goes.
That's right.
So you're looking at a good month before people will, like, once they, you know, basically pull the trigger, it takes about a month before it's sort of fully going, whatever is happening in either the state or the company or what have you. So.
Yes, you know, my view on this is just a personal one. In the absence of a vaccine or even a proven therapy, if you don't have to be somewhere, you know, why take the risk? If you can do your job like virtually or online.
I'm just curious your thoughts on this, because this could be a very controversial question. But do you think that the vaccine is really the panacea solution, or do you think it's a psychological release that people are using that as a demarcation that they could start living, quote unquote, the new normal? Because there's parts of me that you know, I don't really know if that's ultimately the ultimate solution.
I think it's certainly part of it. It's, you know, I think of it like the flu vaccine, right? So there's some protection, not 100% as with most vaccines. There's also going to be an element of choice, right? So some people will not want to take the vaccine, even if it's available. You know, so that in and of itself creates a certain level of risk.
Right.
And it's going to take time to see, you know, how protective these new vaccines will be.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
So we have a few people on the line, but I think we're just for the interest of time, and we have so many juicy things to talk about. Yeah. And I could already tell that we're going to have a great old time, Eddie.
Absolutely.
And the time goes, by the way, because I really like to get into this stuff. So I think what we're going to do is I'm going to ask the team to get everybody out of the waiting room. Kirstie's going to let me know when she's starting to record, and then we're just going to get started.
Wonderful.
We're good to go.
Awesome. Hi, everybody. My name is Natalie Yeadon, and I'm the co-owner and managing director with Impetus Digital. And so if you're not already familiar with what our company does, let me offer up a summary. At Impetus, we offer numerous numbers of cutting-edge synchronous and asynchronous virtual collaboration tools. And these tools are used by a myriad of life science companies and other interested healthcare stakeholders for things like virtual advisory boards, investigator meetings, medical education rollouts. But, you know, since the COVID-19, a lot of internal teams have been using this for brand planning rollouts and POA rollouts and things like that. So there's been an emergency or an emergence of needing to convert in-person meetings to virtual ones. And that's really what Impetus does. But more importantly, Impetus believes that all great ideas start with a conversation. So one of the visions for our company is to go beyond just the brand discussion and beyond the pill into talking about something that's much more, it's much grander, helping to dissect and remove some of the bigger, more provocative issues and getting beyond some of the healthcare stagnation that we see ourselves in. So our online collaboration platform is the perfect place to start some of these conversations. So not only to start them, but to continue them and to sustain them and to build upon them so that we can have some of these big, hairy, audacious conversations, do something really positively and disruptively in healthcare. So really, at the end of the day, the idea behind this fireside chat webinar series is to start some of these conversations and to be able to have conversations with people like Eddie, who are going to help discuss some of the new technologies, the new ideas, the new provocative innovations that we're currently facing and what we can actually do to adapt and to get us moving forward into the quote unquote new normal. So very, very happy to be introducing Eddie Power. Hello, Eddie.
Hi, Natalie. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. And so for those of you who do not know who Eddie Power is, he is actually a very experienced healthcare professional who has been in the pharmaceutical industry for many, many years. not only has been a well endowed leader in the pharmaceutical industry and medical affairs and clinical research, but also, which is really nice to see, has a very strong business background. So that's a beautiful thing to see in the pharmaceutical industry. So he does have an MBA and has worked with several companies over his very well-established career, including working for Cubist, Schering Plow, Bayer, and as well as GSK. So he is currently the VP of North America Medical Affairs in the hospital business at Pfizer. And he also currently sits on the board for Saving Promise. So thank you, Eddie, so much for making the time to sit with our group and for speaking with me today.
My pleasure.
Absolutely. So we were just talking a little bit about how we're sort of delving into the COVID-19, what we've been doing then and what we're doing now, I guess, 2 or 3 months later. How has this affected your life and what you're doing with your medical affairs position at Pfizer?
It's a great question, Natalie. I think like many of us, we have transitioned to more of a virtual and an online way of engagement. It's certainly a change from the way we've been used to doing things with face-to-face meetings. In a way, it's also enabled, right, some connections, whereas we may have lost others. But all in all, I think it's also been pushing us and challenging us to look at new and different ways of doing things. You know, it's a good impetus for change. It's an opportunity to do something that's longer lasting and that may be a more effective, a more efficient way of interacting with the healthcare community at large.
Very interesting. And so what we have found at Impetus is that COVID-19, fortunately or unfortunately, has acted a bit like a change accelerant and a change agent simultaneously. So I guess my question for you is, a lot of leaders like yourself have struggled with incorporating technology at such a rapid pace. There's been concerns about over-zooming and, you know, overindulgence on the technical side. Some people are concerned about control and being able to trust and create new endpoints of determination of performance of employees. So there's a lot hitting leaders like yourself. How are you endeavoring to manage this and to be the change agent that you are looking to create?
So I always look at change as something that requires a certain mindset, a certain willingness to experiment, a certain willingness to actually be allowed to fail and learn from that failure. I mean, after all, that's how most of our great scientific and medical discoveries came to pass. We certainly try as a team and as an organization stay connected. As much as we can virtually. We have to be cognizant that when we're not interacting personally, we're only really using 2 of our 5 senses that we would normally use in an in-person situation. So I think it's being cognizant of some of the limitations that brings. You know, it's becoming more comfortable with the technology. It can be taxing. Being on camera 24/7, not all of us are trained actors and actresses who are used to being in a film, right, or in a video, what have you. But you know, I always like try and take a step back, and we're all very comfortable already with technology in our personal lives. You know, with our iPhones, with our iPads, with our social online networks. So it's really just trying to take that personal mindset and now apply it into a new work situation, and try really and embody those behaviors and accept that there is going to be change, accept that sometimes it will be hard, but at the end of the day, we're all very adaptable as human beings, and it's something that I think we will become much more comfortable and adept at.
Absolutely, and again, lots and lots of change coming at a very rapid and in a very expansive way. you and I first got introduced because I had the joy of being able to watch your presentation called Changing the Discussion Around Medical Affairs and Real World Evidence recently at a virtual conference. And one of the major themes that came from your discussion was on systems thinking. Now, this is a really big concept. Some people don't even know what systems thinking is. And so I want to kind of delve a little bit into that. So maybe you can first of all tell us how you first came or stumbled across systems thinking and what does it mean to you?
Yes, so to me, actually partly through my MBA, you know, there's been some formal study around systems thinking in areas beyond healthcare initially. So I've always had an interest in what that looks like. And to me, it really means that we should be aware that any type of intervention or any type of action we have has implications and reactions in areas that you probably wouldn't normally anticipate. And we're seeing it with the COVID pandemic, where initially there was a healthcare intervention that was designed to protect public health. And there have been a number of consequences and ripple effects that have arisen through that, you know, some economic, some financial, some personal, some emotional, you know, some support systems have been removed. So, you know, when I think of that in terms of a medical affairs role, you know, every time we engage with somebody in the healthcare space, whatever we do, whether it be something around a medicine, whether it be something around sharing information, our actions have some kind of effect. And I've always felt that it's good to take a step back and look at that picture more holistically, rather than just focus on what we have defined ourselves as being our role or what others have defined for us as being our roles.
And it's a really, really interesting point. And so I know that systems thinking has come in a whole variety of flavors. Roger Martin, who's a very, you know, infamous guru here in Toronto at the University of Toronto, has written a book on integrative decision making. And it comes in all sorts of varieties about innovation, systems innovations. But the whole premise, I guess, behind systems thinking is instead of just creating the Me Too drug or the one-upmanship or the slightly better efficacy or, you know, a different dosing option, is you're suggesting looking at healthcare in a more collective, holistic way. And what better time than right now when we're smack dab, right in the middle of it, you know, emerging from a pandemic, than to be able to look at it this systematically. And I think I'd like you to get to speak about how you have used the analogy of the mechanic versus the transportation guru. Can you talk a little bit to paint a more granular picture of what mechanical or the machinations or what we do on a day-to-day versus trying to look at healthcare in a much, like you said, holistic way?
Yeah, so typically the analogy I use with a mechanic working on a car is, you know, traditionally medical affairs, we focused on a medicine, and maybe new medicine, and we normally compare X to Y, and then look at the data that arise from that in terms of efficacy, in terms of safety, potentially in terms of health economics and cost effectiveness down the line. And it's akin to a mechanic, you know, changing oil in the car, changing from natural oil to synthetic oil and looking at what that does for the performance. But, you know, that is a property intrinsic to the car in that case or to the medicine. But the context in which you use that medicine or place that car is very different. You know, the analogy that I used with a car is if in an intrinsic property is that you can go from 0 to 60 in 6 seconds, that is only relevant in where you place that car. If you place that within a city environment with a number of traffic lights, pedestrian crossings, roundabouts, that 0 to 60 may largely become irrelevant. if you place that car on a racetrack, then that may actually be a key intrinsic property of that car, but it only becomes evident in that context. And I think of our approach in medical affairs the same way. We can put a medicine into a system, but then we got to anticipate or try and predict what those changes are. We may have something that changes infusion time from 60 minutes to 2 minutes. And that, in terms of a patient quality of life, may actually be a benefit in terms of how the nursing staff deal with that, whereas before they were occupied for an hour, now for 2 minutes, that may impact how their resourcing is needed. The clinic may not have the capacity to increase the number of patients going through in any given hour. The change from that 60 minute to 2 minute hypothetical drug may also have an impact on the pharmacy. You know, what time does the pharmacy need now to reconstitute this new formulation? How stable is it once it's put on a cart to get to that patient? So if you take that step back, then you start appreciating and anticipating different stakeholder needs across the system. And it's not just the physician who may be interested in efficacy and safety. It may be the nurse who's interested in administration and dosing. It's the pharmacist who's interested in reconstitution. It's the resource manager who's wondering how they're going to manage patient flow within their institution. And then it's the patient or the caregiver in terms of what that means for them in terms of their health outcomes, of course, but then what does that do beyond that for them in terms of quality of life? So those are just some examples where I was trying to use that analogy of the mechanic versus the transportation guru, where I think medical affairs has a tremendous role to play.
There's so many really great things in there, and I'm going to want to linger on each component in a moment. But one of the things I think really draws my attention to what you said is the systems thinking feels very much almost like a Jenga block structure. So keeping in mind that if you pull one of those Jenga blocks, although in within the realm of your context or your unidirectional view on it, that it seems perfectly fine. But the thing is, the whole structure depends on everything else. And so if you remove one block, it can have ramifications on the entire structure. So I think what you said, I think is really important, is sometimes I think what can happen in pharma or, you know, various other stakeholder areas in the space is that we can oftentimes, through a myriad of different issues, one of them being groupthink, or going to see the same people either internally or externally as customers, is that we create our own stories and our own viewpoints in a very unidirectional based on the context that we're coming from. So I think that you discussing context is so absolutely important. So now that we're in this post-COVID new normal, and as we're emerging into this new place, and as we're starting to navigate these new opportunities using technology, do you foresee there being an opportunity to engage with all of these different Jenga blocks or these different components, specifically people and characters and archetypes around the healthcare space? How do you see the two merging so that we can expand the multi-direction expand the context in which we're evaluating how the system flows?
So I think that the biggest advantage or benefit that technology can bring is enabling that holistic view. When you interact person to person or in a group setting or on a one-on-one, intrinsically you're limited to that engagement at that fixed point in time without being able to engage, with other stakeholders that may be interconnected with the group or that person that you're engaging with. So what technology enables is to have all those different stakeholders, all those overlapping, I think of it as a Venn diagram, that you can probably interconnect with at the same time, or even asynchronously, but it allows everyone to be aware and understand what each part of the system, each person interacting with that system, is doing. It allows a more holistic view of, for example, a patient once they engage with a hospital system all the way through to when they're discharged and head home. On the financial side of things, I think it allows overall visibility across budgets, right? That even within a system are controlled within different departments, within different functions, with different stakeholders. Some of those budgets are held by providers, some are held by payers, some are held by the pharmaceutical companies. So technology, I think, will enable that. We're not there yet by any means, but it allows us to step away from our immediate environment that we're experiencing and be able to have this holistic vision or view of that world that we're interacting with.
And it really brings up a good point. And quite frankly, I have to sort of bring in the case of what's happening with our company. A lot of people will try to start endeavoring into understanding the patient journey. We do patient journey mapping and we do treatment pathway profiling. But the problem is it's very unidimensional and it's very contextual from the side of pharma. And one of the reasons it's been very expensive in the past to bring people together in person to be able to collect and solicit information. And so one of the opportunities now is being able to leverage technology so that you can have a myriad of conversations in a myriad of different contexts to create that more holistic systems thinking picture. So you actually said something about we're not quite there yet. And you working in a large pharmaceutical, highly regulated company, but we're all just working in a highly regulated industry, is what do you see as being some of the concerns about being a little bit more far-reaching, about being a little bit more avant-garde as it relates to, taking on new technologies or new methodologies or new thinking processes? What are some of those obstacles and challenges?
So one of them is obviously around human behavior. You know, we all tend to be comfortable with what we are familiar with. This kind of approach tends to take us out of those comfort zones personally, but even within a large corporation, regardless of whether it's pharmaceuticals or any other industry, there are roles that are defined. By taking this approach, you start stepping potentially around those roles, either how they've been defined formally or how they are perceived to function. So that's just the internal challenge. Then when you start stepping outside that into a space beyond your own, into a hospital or interacting with a pair, I think you start getting some of those same dynamics of interaction. What was the norm and what is the new change that is coming down the track? So the certainly that behavioral component, that mindset that we all live with personally, there's an organizational and a structural component around that, because in a way it also leads to more transparency right across the system. In areas where there are things like intellectual property, where there are different ways of looking at revenue streams, what gives some organization a competitive advantage over others, with all players, right? Whether it be manufacturers, or whether it be providers, whether it be payers, I think this kind of starts opening up that black box to an extent. And we have to be cognizant of that. And at the same time, there's also concerns around security and cybersecurity by moving online. And that raises a host of other issues around data privacy, as an example. at the individual level, the HIPAA Act, you know, in the US. So it's there's a complexity, I think, there that we still need to really come to terms with, but I think also have the right governance and framework within which to operate.
Yeah, so really, really important stuff. And I really feel strongly that some of these barriers, issues, and opportunities are going to start dismantling and building on each other just by some of these, starting these conversations. And I know they're happening all over the world, and I'm very, very intrigued by it and very excited about the possibilities. So let's actually just start with the internal things, first of all, some of the internal compliance and some of the traditional business model concepts that are being challenged. And I think one of them, in a very traditional way, is that the sales rep was the way to the future, was the connecting point to the customer. These days, we've been hearing a lot of new things like hospital vendor credentialing and the inability for companies like pharmaceutical companies being able to get in. How are we re-looking and evaluating? And is this something that is going to cause a lot of fear and a lot of, you know, backlash and retaliation? Or do you feel that pharma is just going to have to really rethink what it means to have people in the field?
My opinion is certainly that we're going to have to rethink. I think there's going to be certainly an opportunity and a need to have people in the field, whether it be a sales rep, whether it be a medical science liaison, because some of that, I think, really should be driven by the stakeholder or the customer. You know, we see it in some industries, right? I bank, and my bank gives me the option of how I want to interact with them. You know, do I want a phone call? Do I want an in-branch visit? Do I want an email? Do I want something that's on a website and I do a self-service approach? And I think for pharma, we should also be thinking around those lines. But there's also something, I think, that goes beyond that, because the implication behind a field visit or a field-based interaction is that it's live and at a fixed point in time. You know, I think we can also, one of the things we've been discussing, certainly within our teams, is can we actually have asynchronous engagements where the medical science liaison records a video or a podcast and leaves it somewhere or places it somewhere that's accessible for that healthcare practitioner as an example to access in his or her own time. So it's a very different way of thinking about things. It's also a very different way. We're going to have to come up with metrics, you know, to measure the effectiveness and the efficiencies of that type of approach relative to some of the more standard and traditional ones that we've been using so far.
You bring up some really interesting things around the asynchronous. And one of the things that comes to my mind, and this could be a little controversial, but when you start to talk about asynchronous, you're now dismantling the barriers or the boundaries that were once very prevalent. And that was regionalization, meaning you had to be in the same physical territory, same geographical space, within, you know, driving distance or whatever. You had to have multiple regional affiliates, offices, to be able to get the message. So you mentioned something that's really interesting. If there was a centralized place where there was a podcast or a recording, it really does ask the question of, is regionalization of offices, companies, really going to be relevant in the future, or is that going to be consolidated into one single space?
It's a great question. So I think of that in two ways. I think if you're talking about content or delivery of information, that obviates the need, I think, for any kind of local or regional type of approach, assuming, right, that there's no need for a particular local interaction. And that may be predicated by other structural things like time zone. But if we go back to our early part around systems thinking, though, there needs to be an understanding of how that content or that information is going to sit within that system, right? So what context is that going to be placed in? And how is that context going to be acted upon by the consumers of that information? So that may still require some more local or regional knowledge. But the other consideration with the asynchronous is that your time frame shifts. So there's an option now not to do things at a fixed point in time for a fixed period. You can actually have a discussion or an engagement that may span a few days, a few weeks, a few months that may actually lead to a richer type of engagement than that one-off engagement that we so often are used to.
Yeah, absolutely. So it is interesting. And I think on that same vein, Eddie, is when we're talking about the systems concept, we're sort of just kind of playing with some of these ideas. Does it give us pause to think about even some of the regulatory bodies that we have? We're thinking right now that there are approval bodies that exist in the US, in Europe, in Canada, in you know, a myriad of other countries. And we've sort of seen some of these experimental or these pilots that are going on where you're having forces merging together and making these decisions and quick on the uptake of new pricing codes and costing codes and all sorts of things that are happening very rapidly. Is this going to be the new norm? Do you think there's the possibility, or do you think people are going to retaliate and kind of get frigid on it and want to go back to what they're used to? So there's an opportunity opening, but do some people not see it that way? And when we look at this holistically as a system, could that be the way of the future?
I definitely think that there's an opportunity for regulators to look at how they conduct, you know, their business too. They're an integral part of the same system. So we're seeing some of those changes with the COVID pandemic, you know, as an example. So, you know, accelerated paths through development, accelerated paths through approval. I think it may need tweaking. You know, this is kind of a fixed period in time in a way, but I do think there's certainly an opportunity for that kind of holistic look. And I think there's also an opportunity, frankly, for regulators themselves to take a more global view of what they do and how they work together in circumstances such as this, which is a global pandemic, and how can they look at their processes collectively beyond the confines, you know, of their geographies and how those rules engage. Again, you know, I think it's going to take an expansionist and a visionary mindset for that to happen. I think there may be some global organizations, WHO, UNICEF, and the like, who are perhaps more attuned to that kind of global thinking. But I think it's something that we should certainly push and strive towards. Always, of course, putting in place some boundaries that make sure that, you know, at the end of the day, that whatever the patient is receiving is safe, you know, is efficacious, and is also done, I think, in an ethical manner.
Yeah, so beautifully said, Eddie. And I think that brings up a whole slew of questions and opportunities as it relates to things like clinical studies and clinical trials. And what does that look like in the future? And who are the players around the table? So as you obviously know, is, you know, we currently work with a whole ecosystem of investigators and clinical research organizations and a whole myriad of other people involved in that process. With the potential democratization of healthcare. So now suddenly we're using telemedicine. And instead of being one-to-one, there's a possibility of one-to-many. So as we talk about potentially the consolidation and even of physicians, probably of being able to now manage a myriad of patients as opposed to singles based on geographical proximity, is what does the new clinical trial look like? Who's going to be involved? And where do you think technology is going to play in that new space?
So already seeing a shift towards greater engagement of patients, potentially some of their caregivers. There are areas, I think, where technology lends itself better to conducting virtual clinical trials, at least have a component of that, through wearables, through iPhones, through other ways of gathering data, right through technology. And those, to my mind, tend to be in those areas of chronic disease, or rare disease, where there's a kind of longevity around the disease process and how that process is managed. I think it becomes a little bit more challenging in acute conditions. Infection is a good example of that. And I think like today with COVID, because in a way you're kind of reacting to an event that doesn't allow you to put all those different parameters in place. So there's certainly scope. I know there's conversation around having in silico clinical trials where there's absolutely no personal or physical interaction. The challenge I think still with that is that we really need to fully understand our biology. And even today, if you look at some of our drugs and you look at some of the approved labels, there's often a statement in there that says the mechanism of action is unknown or the mechanism of action is not fully known. And that makes it difficult, right, to build an algorithm that is accurate, that takes into account biological variation, and that can be applied across a whole population. So I think there's still some learning. I do think that there's scope to move towards that. The way I personally see it is that it probably starts at an earlier phase in the process, where traditionally we may be using animal models. That's probably a good testing ground and a good pilot to look at some of these in silico approaches. And see if those are predictive of what may happen in humans.
So you bring up a really great point around clinical studies. I think that we're seeing a lot of this, and some companies are scrambling because of their clinical studies having had to stop because of COVID-19, and a lot of studies are restarting. And some people are even reconsidering some of their clinical endpoints that perhaps some of the clinical endpoints that we have been traditionally using are not as resilient as they could be. And so rethinking, how do we start using real items, real phones, real sensors, and maybe the acceleration of these, and incorporating these in clinical trials so they can be more resilient. People can, as you were mentioning, contextually be the determinants, the patient can be the determinant of and choose where they're going to participate from the trial. Are they going to be doing this from their summer home? Do they have to go in and be audited real time? Can they use other devices? And all of these can be collected and be appropriate endpoints so that clinical trials can be more efficient and they can be more broad stroking and involve more people across the globe. Is this a vision and an opportunity that you see?
I do. To pick on a specific example, traditionally there's a time frame for treatment that's defined a priori, right? And it may be a 7-day treatment, a 10-day treatment. And typically that fixed point is based on for historical reasons. And if you go back far enough, the reasons why that initial time frame was chosen may be unclear. But when you start getting to comparative trials, you compare that an endpoint at a fixed point in time, you know, against whatever the other drug you're comparing with had also looked at. I think with wearables, you start getting real-time feedback on some of those endpoints. And when some of those endpoints or cures, right, may actually be happening. So, you know, you may find that actually, you know, 80% of patients are cured after 3 days, way before that 10-day endpoint that you had chosen, you know, that you had chosen in advance. So there's certainly, I think, opportunity there to really reimagine how we think about certain endpoints like cure. So I think there's still some other areas with wearables that also fundamentally, I think, are changing the practice of medicine or will change the practice of medicine. So we're going to have a constant stream of data, like blood pressure measurements, 24/7. Typically before, you'd manage that by a once in a year visit at a wellness visit. In a clinical trial at fixed points in time when you define your visits. But how do we analyze blood pressure in the context of biological variability, you know, that may have ebbs and flows at different times during the day, you know, while somebody's sleeping versus when somebody's exercising, when somebody's eating, and how do you choose those appropriate points in time to say this is the blood pressure measure that is actually going to give me the relevant number to manage either the patient or to manage the endpoint in a clinical study. So there's I think still some learning and some relearning and some reimagining for us to do.
I absolutely love that thought and the concept of a moving target, and the variability is so brilliant, and also a potentially amazing opportunity if we started inserting artificial intelligence and machine learning to this data. Because really, I think what you're speaking to, Eddie, is the opportunity for N=1 treatments. So based on individualized chemistries and neural circuitries, and all the other potential, you know, singledoms that we all as our single humans will have with a particular intervention. So it does bring us to the question of making this data available. We currently talk about these ideas of data lakes. I like to eventually talk about these as data oceans, being able to, you know, confluence this from a myriad of locations to tap into. And then tapping in, you know, because as you know, data is the new gold and the new oil. These machines or these machine learning units gobble up data, and this is how they get smarter. But then we hit the head with the whole issue around bioethics and data privacy and security. And then the overarching question of, is this my ownership of my data, or is this something that I need to be sharing? So what's shareable versus what's owning? Can you speak to, first of all, that as an opportunity? And secondly, how do you sort of see us navigating through some of these really big, crunchy topics around bioethics?
So I'll start with the first point around artificial intelligence and machine learning. There's tremendous opportunity there. If you just take a piece of it, which is medical knowledge that traditionally has been disseminated in the form of publications, right, in medical or scientific journals. And traditionally, the way we've been taught is there's a senior experienced person who may be a professor who imparts, you know, his or her knowledge, you know, based on their own experience, based on their reading of the literature, based on their understanding of the data. But data's expanded exponentially, and now it's not just data that's published within scientific journals, and there's millions of those already to start with. It's data that's being generated through online platforms like Google, right? Google searches on flu give a fantastic idea of how a flu epidemic may be spreading. So the artificial intelligence or machine learning actually gives us the opportunity to harness all of that data in a data ocean, as you articulated, that in a way takes out the need for having those scientific journals if it can aggregate all of that. And you have the opportunity to interrogate that ocean for the particular set of data that you need, whether it be managing a disease, right? Whether it be managing a condition, whether you're trying to look as if a new medicine might interact with another, you know, what kind of outcomes may appear further down the line. It's a tremendous opportunity and a tool, and something that's already been used in a way, right, to help with diagnosis and give the likelihood of a diagnosos in an ER setting when somebody's admitted versus a physician or a nurse practitioner having to make that diagnosis without that assistance. And then the data ownership and privacy, absolutely, I think, is a bioethical minefield. You know, we see it already in our personal lives, right, with social apps. You know, is the fact that you download an app and set up a profile, transfer ownership automatically to the creator of the app? Or do you still have that right to own your own data and privacy? And you can expand that beyond the person in this artificial intelligence machine learning environment. You know, what becomes intellectual property for an organization? You know, what becomes the property of a healthcare provider versus that of the patient? What becomes the property of an institution if somebody's admitted for some kind of therapy or treatment? There's a number of considerations here that are very real. And I think there's going to be a difference in approach, right? A, depending on culture, and by that I mean different countries have different appetites for sharing data. It may come down to personal choice, you know, how we feel about sharing some of those data, and it may also come down to regulation. You know, what does that mean for a business in terms of IP? You know, what does that mean in terms of sharing data from safety and efficacy around our medicine. So complex and a broad environment, but I think something that we really all need collectively to start thinking about carefully.
No, absolutely, 100% agree with you. And it brings up some other really interesting ideas around these data oceans and privacy and what does this look like. And I think it also paints the picture of just even a recent state of affairs with this whole concept of paying exorbitant amounts of money for tracers in the COVID-19 pandemic. And there is legislative choice in doing so instead of utilizing and building up the smart or the AI of the app that was created between Apple and Google on sort of automatizing, if you will, this tracing. And it can't get better until it has data, and then there's pushback on it. So governments are actually making that choice because of the concept of privacy. So I think we're right in the middle of kind of that line in the sand about people who want to progress forward. And then this whole issue around, well, that's private information and we don't want to, you know, get into that field of landmines. So one of the things that I think is also important in this is we're also being faced with an issue around universal basic income, high unemployment right now. In the new world, as we become more resilient as economies and start to bring manufacturing and ability to normalize and bring in our own ability to provide materials, and you know, that's everything from drugs to units that we're buying from other countries. These may actually not necessarily result in extra jobs. They may be automated through robotics. So the question comes down to things like UBI, universal basic income, and what we're going to do. So one of the potential solutions that comes into play is this idea of monetizing people's health data. And how do we do this? Well, the concept is through blockchain. If there was a way or a methodology of connecting people's health through just, you know, normal use of things like people's phones, sensors, they're typing on their computer, watching TV, and then having, you know, smart TVs, being able to use facial recognition, and this information gets dumped into these data oceans, and then they can be used for population health management and research. And every time somebody uses your data, you get paid through the blockchain. Is that science fiction, or do you think that's a really, really scary idea?
I think it's a scary idea, but I think it can also have benefit, right? And so the monetization part of it is one, right? With blockchain, you own that data. Then, you know, typically the way blockchain works, I think, as many of you know, is through sharing some kind of key, right? And that key can be private or can be public. And in and of itself, that may also create issues around security, right? And data security. So yes, I think there's an opportunity for a person, right, or a patient to monetize that data. Right now, it's not just because I signed up to an app that everyone's gonna have those data for free. Now, there has to be some kind of positive action, say on my behalf, if I've signed up to that, for somebody to use that. And I may want some form of compensation for that. But there's a scary piece after that step is taken, because one of the things with blockchain is it's a permanent record and you can't alter that permanent record. So once you take that step, and again, this relates back to data privacy and data security, it's indelible. And then are we comfortable with having that data out there that may not change, right? And imagine what happens if you, say in the US, if you have to change health insurers. There's a record there that's indelible that may have been something that happened at a point in time, but is there forever. You know, what does that do in terms of that transparency? What does that do in terms of who's using those data? So there's pros and cons, particularly in the healthcare space. I don't know that we've really solved that. But, you know, it's something I think that we're going to hear more and have more bioethical discussions around, frankly.
Yeah, and I love it. And I'm looking forward to those discussions. And there's many, many other discussions. I could literally speak with you, to you and with you, Eddie, for hours, because this is stuff that is so super interesting. And I love the fact that you bring the medical and the business side to things, and really would love to hear more from you on the systems thinking, because everything that we've been talking about today has this big, hairy, audacious, systemic approach and way about it. So I'm very excited to see some of the things that you're going to be able to contribute to the industry. And then on that note, to all of the other people who are listening here today, is these are some of the big questions that are at the table. And, you know, these are beyond the pill conversations. This is a great opportunity as we emerge from this pandemic to start dissembling and getting into reductionist thinking, bringing things back to their bare basics, and then finding new patterns and new reconnections. And everything starts with conversations like this. And this is ultimately what Impetus's mission and vision to do is to be the platform to allow these conversations to start creating new patterns and to create these connections. So thanks to everybody who's attended. For anybody who's interested, and check out our previous fireside chats, you don't want to miss any of them or any of our future updates. We will be providing links after this session, both here and a myriad of different ways. We'll send you a follow-up to access this, and you can access our newsletter, and you can follow us on YouTube, LinkedIn, Twitter, and Buzzsprout, because we have a podcast as well, and we'll follow that. We will also include a link for Eddie to find him on LinkedIn. And is there any other way, Eddie, before we go, how people can find you if they're interested in connecting with you?
LinkedIn is by far the easiest.
Which is awesome. And what if there was one thing that you would share with this group before we leave about your hope and vision for healthcare in this new post-COVID new normal, what would you say?
So for me, I would say that this is, I think, has been the opportunity to be more collaborative in how we approach healthcare as a whole. You know, we're seeing collaborations between pharmaceutical companies, whereas before it may have been more of a competitive type of environment. We're seeing more collaboration with our healthcare communities, with our regulators. So to me, that is my great hope, that we look at this as an opportunity to be collaborative, to celebrate each other's successes, and last of all, to make sure that whatever solutions we come up with are accessible by all.
Absolutely, beautifully, beautifully said. Thank you again, Eddie Power, VP of Medical Affairs at Pfizer. Thank you so much for your time, and wishing you and everybody who's attended a wonderful day ahead.
Thank you, Natalie. Stay safe.
You too.